say this is the last presentation. I get to have another cup of coffee and all wake up again, so that's a good thing. I'd just like to explain the title of our presentation, because if you look on your programme, it actually says being a verification to avoid adulteration. When Pete and I were putting this presentation together, we debated the whole use of the word adulteration. And as you heard from the speaker this morning, it's often been associated with conscious addition of something that you shouldn't have in the food. We really thought about this in terms of the manufacturing, because what we're talking about here is how manufacturers avoid adulteration to the food. And because I'd like to give manufacturers the benefit of the doubt, I would like to think of it more as cross-contamination rather than adulteration. So that's why we came up with this pattern. Okay, I want to start, this is probably cleaning 101 for most of you, but with a couple of definitions. Firstly, of cleaning and then of disinfection. When we're talking about cleaning and disinfection in terms of microbial removal, they're both equally as important. The cleaning removes the gross debris and the disinfection then kills the organisms. When you're talking about removal of extraneous matter, proteins, species, allergens, the cleaning is probably more important. The disinfection doesn't actually remove any more of the material that needs to be removed, which it might do something different, which is what I'm explaining here. So cleaning, fairly straightforward, can be used in conjunction with chemicals like detergents or sanitizers, but will remove the majority of the material so that you can have something that looks visually clean when you finish. The disinfection, if you then apply a disinfectant or you use a heat disinfection, what might happen is that you will remove the microorganisms, but with anything else that's left there, you may actually just change the structure of it so that it can't be detected. It may still actually be present, and that can be an issue when we're looking at verification of the cleaning process to see whether or not we've actually removed what we need to remove, in this case things like allergens or species. Why clean? Again, this is probably teaching most of you what you already know, but I thought it was worth stating again. Obviously, mostly we do things for food safety reasons, so to remove things like microbes or allergen residues. Obviously, now we're focusing more on the product residues, including things like species. So, whereas before manufacturers have cleaned for food safety reasons and some food quality reasons, they've now got an additional reason to do that because of the species cross-contamination that we've seen. We can also use cleaning to remove chemical residues and for removing just foreign body matter, so anything else that might then contaminate the food. There's also another whole raft of reasons why we would do cleaning, and that would include the legal requirements, brand protection, discouraging pests, health and safety, and production efficiencies. But within this talk, we're really going to concentrate on the removal of cross-contamination. So cleaning involves these four factors, and I think this is very important as well. Often people think there's a magic bullet to cleaning, they can just use one thing and that will result in a perfect clean. It is a combination of chemicals, time, the temperature of the water or chemicals that you use, and most importantly, the time and effort that you put into the cleaning. This is particularly important for manual cleaning. I put there that the importance of each of these types of factors will depend on the type of cleaning that we're doing. And if we go on to the types of cleaning that we might do, talking about interim cleans, product changeover, daily cleans, or periodic deep cleans. And the emphasis that we put on each of those cleans, amount of effort we put in, will depend on the importance of maintaining the lack of cross-contamination from one thing to another. So for interim cleans, traditionally we might not really do a deep clean, but now we might need to consider that if we're changing from pork to beef, for instance, rather than wait until the end of the day when we might do a deep clean at the end of the day, or waiting even 6 months for a periodic deep clean. So the level of cleaning required has possibly increased. We also need to think about the type of methodology that we use for cleaning, and that will be denoted by the product type. Again, because of the changes in attitude with the species cross-contamination issue, the product type is even more important than it used to be. We might not just be looking from changing from a green pasta to a white pasta on a nutrient clean, as I say, from one species to another, so the level of cleaning increases. It will also depend on the type of equipment to be cleaned, whether it's a flat surface or a closed system. We will have tried to conduct risk assessments as part of our HACCP plan to ensure that we're doing the right cleaning for the right process. And we may use third-party advice. And obviously some of the most recent advice has come out about species verification, currently set by the FSA at 1% crossover for contamination. We may also think about what's happened in the press lately, that may refocus our efforts, and obviously the recent incident is one of those. And also increasing customer demands. Not only has this hit us from a practical point of view, and the press have made a big story of it, it means that the customer awareness of the issues in the food industry have been raised again. So our customer expectations are also increased. With regards to the types of cleans that we do, I've spoken about the different types of cleans for different purposes. Really they fall into three main categories. We've got the manual cleaning, we've got closed system cleaning, which we call things like CIP or foaming, and then we've got mechanical cleans. Now I'm going to focus on manual cleaning because there's one important aspect of that that's very different from the CIP or the backwash cleaning, and that is that the key factor in the cleaning when manual cleaning is involved, other people. And whereas we can rely on regulated systems with pumps and temperature probes for the CIP, we can't always rely on the person who's doing the cleaning to do it properly or do it as thoroughly as they've been trained to do. So manual cleaning requires a number of things, including the appropriate cleaning equipment, cleaning chemicals, trained staff. Because we've got people that are operating the chemicals, we need personal protective clothing. We also need time, so it takes time for things to be manually cleaned. And we also need effort. So it really is about how long you scrub for and how hard you scrub, which will achieve the cleaning overall. Now, obviously, here's a selection of cleaning equipment, and unfortunately, my sales manager isn't in the room. It doesn't really matter whose equipment you use, as long as you're using the right equipment. And the right equipment to achieve the aim that you're trying to get to at the end. So for removal of the contamination that you're interested in. One thing that I will come on to you in the next couple of slides is that your cleaning equipment also needs to be cleanable, because it in itself can be a source and a vector of contamination. So the hygienic design of cleaning equipment is something you might want to consider in the future. For the chemicals, we need to think about the soil you need to remove. So in the case of meat species, we're talking about protein-based soil, so the chemicals that you use need to be able to help remove that soil more efficiently. They also need to be compatible with the equipment that you're using, so they don't actually corrode or pit the equipment. The occupational exposure of the staff to the chemicals needs to be considered. Obviously, with manual cleaning, that person is going to be in direct contact with the chemicals, maybe with a barrier for protective clothing, but it needs to be suitable for that. You also have to have compatibility with the equipment that you're using for cleaning. So you don't want something that falls to pieces as soon as you put it in the ground. And the chemicals that you choose will be based on the level of cleaning that you require. So you've got the cleaning, you've got the sanitisation, and or maybe disinfection. This, I think, is one of the key areas where manual cleaning comes down or can actually stand up, and that's in the staff that you use for the cleaning procedure. They are a vital part of the cleaning process. A brush or a squeegee or a deck scrub won't clean the area itself. It needs somebody to operate it. But actually, the staff are part of the cleaning equipment. And as such, they should be properly trained in the use of the chemicals that they're going to use and of the cleaning equipment. And that's so that you can achieve the best clean possible and minimise the risk of cross-contamination. They have to be issued with the appropriate PPE in relation to the task that they're conducting. And most of all, they need to be conscientious and be able to devote the time and the effort required to achieve the cleaning required. Often, unfortunately, any hygiene team member will tell you their time is usually cut in preference to production because they don't make money, production does. But I suggest that if your cleaning isn't right and you then subsequently have a food safety or food quality issue, the bad press that can result from that can cost the company a lot more than investing a bit more time in cleaning that provides you at the end of the day. It's not only the way that you clean to remove the soil from the equipment that's important, it's also the fact that cleaning activities in themselves can spread contamination. So if you're cleaning on one line and you are trying to do something on another line where you don't want the cross-contamination to happen, it is quite likely if you don't screen or segregate that line in some way while you're doing it. This is some data from some research work that I did on at Camden, where we looked at the amount of contamination in the air, so microbial contamination in the air, generated under different activities. So in non-production, the amount of bacteria in the air per meter squared is, or meter cubed, sorry, is maybe about 100 parts per meter squared cubed. When you start getting into any of these activities where you're starting to clean, and you're generating aerosols and particles into the air, you can see that by the time you get to floor cleaning, you've generated 10 times greater numbers of bacteria in the air. Then that can travel around the area, settle back into clean surfaces or other food types, and are carrying that contamination with them. It's not just true for bacteria, it can be the same for allergen dusts or protein aerosols from lines where meat has been processed. Wet cleaning is one of the biggest culprits for spreading aerosols. We did some work looking at high pressure hoses and drains, again looking at microbial dispersion, but it can be food-based dispersal too. And here you can see the spread of contamination modelled from the work that we did, where you have the impact of the hose on the floor here, and these are the aerosols and droplets that are formed, spreading to a distance of 7 metres throughout the room and to a height of 4 metres. So again, those aerosols and droplets can then subsequently settle onto food contact surfaces, open food product, and carry with it cross-contamination, which could include allergens and species. Same thing when we looked at dry cleaning. At the top we've got flour sprinkled onto a stainless steel sheet, and then cleaned with a vacuum cleaner, which does a fairly good job, it tends to suck everything up. What's important with vacuum cleaners is that the vacuum exhaust is fitted with a filter, otherwise anything that is sucked in can then instantly be squirted back out again. And obviously this is particularly relevant for dry allergen carriers and spread of contamination there. We've got the same thing on the other side with a broom, which just tends to move the contamination from one place to another. So it's very important to then collect it up at the end using a sufficient system. And then compressed air, which is often used in dry cleaning environments to dislodge food debris that's trapped in small nooks and crannies, but all you then do is spread the contamination over a huge distance where it's almost impossible to gather it together again, particularly important when dealing with allergens. And the graph on the bottom here shows the different particle sizes that hang in the air. Unfortunately, I've lost the numbers along the bottom, but that shows the distribution in the air up to 16 minutes. So allergen particles or any contaminant that can travel in air is going to be hanging there for about 16 minutes and to travel a long way in that distance. Again, onto other food critical surfaces or products. So, if not properly cleaned between uses, I was mentioning that the cleaning equipment itself can be a large source or vector of contamination. Again, we did some work at Camden looking at, in this case, again, microbial contamination in the cleaning brushes and the squeegees themselves, and also in other parts of the food factory. We took 10,000 samples looking for listeria, and on the food production equipment itself, found very low incidence of listeria. On the floors, about 17%, and in the drains, about 25%, which, if any of you know anything about where listeria likes to live, is probably not uncommon. However, we did find 47% of the cleaning equipment was contaminated with listeria. Now again, forget the fact that it's a microbe, think about the fact that it's cross-contamination, and it could be species level contamination, algae contamination, and it shows you the potential that not looking after the cleaning equipment can have on the spread of contamination within the factory. And it also goes back to the hygienic design of that equipment too, how cleanable is it itself. It can be hygiene staff themselves can also be a source of contamination. People are brilliant at spreading all sorts of things around all over the place, particularly bugs, but also allergens, foreign bodies and species. And I came across this really cute little picture on the internet the other day that showed just how far maybe some of our contaminants could spread to the food and whether or not we should actually be playing with more products. So we have here a product, I think it's a Japanese product, and it says, "I'm sorry, they contain traces of what?" And if you can't see the extended logo, it actually says here, "May contain traces of peanut and human flesh." And that's because we all shed in about 10,000 skin particles as we're sitting here every minute. So imagine that in food product. And have we now got to the stage where we actually need to declare that we may, if we include people in the food factory, declare that we have human flesh in our products as well? The detection techniques are so good, maybe we should. Anyway, talking about detection techniques, you heard a little bit this morning about lateral flow devices and how you can validate cleaning within food factories. And Pete is now going to give us a bit more information on that with regard to allergen and food stuff.
Thanks, Debs. Okay. I'm conscious I'm all that stands between you and coffee, tea, and more importantly at the moment, oxygen. Do any of those windows open? And if not, who's got a chair? we'll pay for it later. Right. One of the things that has come up increasingly over this last year, and obviously is very topical with the situations that we've been talking about and touched on some of the things that Barbara mentioned earlier. The definitions, validation, verification and monitoring. So a lot of people tend to use validation and verification as interchangeable terms. Thank you, give that gentleman a biscuit. The flow will be this way. People tend to use validation and verification very much interchangeably in the same way they use disinfectant and sanitizer interchangeably, which coming from a chemical company really winds me up. They're different things. So, validation is about proving something will work. The food scientists amongst you will not be familiar with that definition. The verification is about, did it actually work? Has it worked today? And the monitoring is, did it happen? So, bearing on something that Debs was talking about earlier, I know of one food factory that I've been very active in since Friday evening, including all over the weekend, where they have certainly learnt the cost of not significantly resourcing the hygiene function. And I'm actually going to move in there because it would just save me so much travelling time. just get a bed there. And certainly they haven't been looking at this validation verification and this monitoring. So when we're drawing in some of the techniques that Barbara was talking about earlier with DNA, with, as Deb just said, being really sensitive, you're looking at this end. Has it actually worked? Has the cleaning regime that costs a lot of money actually achieved what we want to? Well, as Deb's already said, we're doing it for various reasons, maybe for food safety reasons, and maybe for species control. Now, I'm very conscious to draw species control out of the food safety bit, because it's not a safety issue. And I was getting very irate with a lot of my companies that we work with when they're all, "Oh, we need a chemical to kill DNA." You can't kill it. It's similar to the situation I've had over these. I need a chemical to kill an allergen. You can't kill an allergen, just clean it. And it's not a species issue, it's not a safety issue. So when I've had companies come to me saying, "We want to look at the product changeover cleans to make sure we're doing the species changeovers properly." Great. For 9 years, I've been trying to get you animated about allergen cleaning, which is a safety issue, and you didn't want to know. Suddenly, somebody put Shergar in something, and we were all panicking and jumping around all over the place. Right, at least we know what happened to him now. It's a requirement of food safety. Sorry, Nick, you're not the only one going to take this. I went to the same politically incorrect school. All the food third-party food safety standards talk about this validation verification. So the M&S standards, TFMS, JS, BRC, It's very animated on validation and verification. Cost-effective execution of the hygiene operations. On one presentation, I did actually misspell operations. It read operatives. And certainly that got a few companies quite interested, which is basically find the peanut suckers, force feed them. And it's about KPIs. You know, the food industry hasn't got a lot of money. It's being screwed down from one end by the suppliers because they want a fair price. Good. Screwed down by the retailers because they want to give the customer a cheap price and maximise their profits. In the middle is this retailer. There's this factory who employs lots of people going, we need to make something. We need the money to be able to do it. You know, if you're paying 97 pence for a pack of six frozen beef burgers, how much meat do you expect to be there? We've taken all the other factors in. So it's all about monitoring these KPIs. With validation methods, we've got good old micro. Who's ever done any micro swabbing? Who's worked in micro labs? Yeah, I've seen a few hands go up, not too many of the students, which is somewhat worrying. Where's Michael? They're asleep in that bit. So traditional micro, you take a swab, you stick it in a lab, and they tell you how many is there. One thing I found universally true with microbiological investigations is that the microbes haven't read the same books we have, and they don't know what they're supposed to do. So they do funny things. Listeria is a good one on that, and so is Campylobacter, that, again, parts of the industry are getting very animated about at the moment. You may be doing DNA analysis. I've included ATP in there purely because it's got to be stuck somewhere, and it sort of fits micro more than anywhere else, but it's not strictly a microbiological testing, and we could do an hour on ATP, but we're not going to because I can see people waving at me. Physical assessment. Yep. Nearly all of us have got one of these either side of our nose, and they tend to work reasonably well. I'm sure Barbara and Deb certainly will agree with me that at 4 o'clock in the morning after you've been there all night, they don't work quite as well as at 10 o'clock at night, but you can see the physical debris. So there's no point carrying out testing a DNA analysis for prawns on a prawn sandwich line if the prawn's sitting on the roller going, hi, still here. You can see it. We're going to use species, so either DNA or ELISA testing. We'll come on to those in a moment. Chemical testing, either by pH paper or test kits. And then with allergens, we've got a spectrum of tests, a couple of which are quite useful for looking for the allergen, and then there's DNA, which isn't quite as good for... Barbara's looking at... Come on, Barbara. Barbara's looking... It's very good. It'll pick it up very sensitively. It's all right, she's busy copying, so she can't help you. And you giving that cheesecake at lunch, come on. Come on to that in a moment or two. Now, question we have to get asked is a chemical supplier. I want a validated detergent to remove an allergen. That's from the intelligent, sort of 0.5% of technical managers. The others are one chemical killer. There is defined standards for disinfectants. So any disinfectant you're using in any of the food manufacturing sites around the EU will have been tested to a defined set of criteria. So they'll have an efficacy. They'll have test data, whether they be quat-based, whether they be Bogwana-based. Hopefully not with the health and safety implication of that one, but that's a different story. Or if they be based on peracetic acids or hydrogen peroxides. But we don't have that efficacy criteria for detergents, primarily because there's so many different methods of application, of soil, of types of materials of construction, which will affect the efficacy. So validation of a cleaning regime, which is really what we're looking at in these last few minutes, isn't about just the detergent or just the disinfectant. As Deb's already said, it's about the whole jigsaw. Now, the chemical can be the best damn chemical in the world, but if it sits in the keg and doesn't hit the surface, it's much use as a chocolate teapot. So you've got to actually validate the whole of the cleaning regime. So if you're getting so involved in studies looking at these things, it's about the whole process, not just about the chemical you're using or the brush you're using, or the green pad that somebody's had tucked in their wellies in their locker for the last fortnight and has finally seen the light of day. You know, those of you at the bidding factories will know that green pads are often tradable commodities. You know, if somebody, you get your green pad, my precious, mine. People jealously guard it. Micro methods, brilliant, but you need a lab. You know, you've got to have a proper micro lab, and also you've got to have the containment facilities to keep the microbes in the lab. You don't want them spreading around the place. Does require any growing of your organisms, and it takes you several days, so you're always working behind yourself. For anybody involved in sandwich manufacture, you know, technical managers, you sneak up behind them and you whisper the word hysteria in their brain, in the back of their. Who mentioned the elbow? Because you've got a product with a 3 or 4 day shelf life that you're waiting for your analysis for 7 days. So by the time you've got a confirmation you had Listeria monocytogenes in your product, it's about the same time as your listeriosis complaints are coming through. It's a bit blooming late. So it's a validation technique. You're always working behind yourself, you're looking for trends. But it is really, for microbes, about the gold standards, about the best we've got, and it is a quantification method. Fair enough. Visual, as I said, most people can see. Certainly if they're in the food factory, if they need to be able to. And a little tip, if you get involved with hygiene teams, remind them they have these, they're called knees. And they allow you to do this. And you can look under things and reach under things and actually look critically at the pieces of equipment. This table would have been beautifully clean on the top, but if you do that, yeah, you can either run under the very edge of the table if you're being kind, or stick your hand right under, arm's length. Yeah, you can feel some debris there where it's been missed, where somebody just hasn't got down on their knees and cleaned the equipment properly. But it is a real-time assessment, and if the staff are trained and know what they're looking for, you've got a chance of getting a reasonably clean factory. With species, this has been talked to death, really, so I'm not going to go into any great detail, but certainly DNA analysis, or you can get on-site ELISA testing, and I'll run you through a case study at the very end of this. I've got time just on how we've utilised that with a couple of factories. Similarly for allergens, again, ELISA, and again, DNA. Those of you who use ELISA testing, it's an art, it's a skill. And as Deb said earlier, with the DNA particularly, it's making sure you don't contaminate it so we don't end up with human flesh. I did actually say for a sausage manufacturer we deal with, who was worried about pork and beef, I said, well, you need to worry about your staff as well, because they weren't wearing gloves. And they did say you may pick up traces of human DNA. Doesn't mean you've got Sweeney Todd in the factory, maybe. I did then go on to say, but it could be even worse if they haven't washed their hands properly and they stroked a cat on the way in. Following week, the BBC published a study about the meat they'd found in the curries, and I stopped using that example for a number of weeks. So, cleaner regimes. Those at the million factories will recognise some of this, so we remove the gross debris, we clean it, we rinse it, we inspect it, we disinfect it, and maybe we rinse it afterwards, depends on the disinfectant we've used and the mood of the hygiene manager that day. Why would we look for micro and allergen in a validation study at the start of a clean? Anybody but Debs?
What's that point? To be able to place presence.
Yep. Both reasons. But is it there? I know a lot of sandwich factories that do more listeria testing pre-clean than post-clean. Great, the results are clear. Did we have it? So yeah, it's to verify, is it there, to look and see what you've got to start with. You then do your visual, physical, allergen, micro test, or species testing after your inspection stage. You then disinfect, carry out your micro testing. Okay. And maybe look for chemicals. Do any food manufacturers here, do you rinse off your disinfectants or not? Some do, some don't. Some are totally ignoring me, others are snoring. Right? You may do, again, depending on what you've used and depending on your risk assessment. There are some safety concerns coming through at the moment about some disinfectants that, as a chemical industry, we're looking at very, very closely to see if it's actually going to be an issue. Because what we've got to do is try and get this balance of chemical safety and food with food safety. You know, the last thing we want is to say, all right, we're not going to use disinfectants anymore. At which point we all go, Listeria, hello, it's still here. With verification, we've got similar methods. And certainly in a validation study, you want to be using your verification methods at the same time. Because then you've got a clear demonstrable link between your validation exercise and the verification you're then doing on a daily basis in the factories. So again, micro, ATP, sort of. Those of you who understand ATP will know why I'm saying that. With the physical assessments, we've got the visual assessment again. Great. It's a real-time method. It's straight away. Chemicals, we can use pH paper. We can use test kits. And with allergens, we've only really got these lateral flow devices, which are very much Marmite within the testing industry. You either love them or hate them. And I know where Barbara sits. But they're okay. All you can say is they're the best we've got. They're best available technology at the moment. But things are changing on that front. excuse me, and then with species, we've got ELISA testing that you can do within about half an hour in some samples, in some factories, and for some species, not for all. Chemical verification, you can test for alkaline test chemicals, the presence of acidics, presence of quat-based disinfectants, so you can see if you've got a chemical residue that may well go on to contaminate the food and give you a problem. And certainly things like the quat and the pH test strips are the quickest and easiest way to get to dip down. If they change colour, it's there. So it's a nice, easy method that even most QA supervisors can use on the second or third attempt. We usually find. Again, with micro, we haven't got a verification method for micro. The closest we've got is ATP. And generally, all you can say with that is we've got a high level of ATP. Therefore, there's something that either is or was alive that's on the surface. So it's not giving you a direct microbiological assessment, but it's telling you there's some. We've had living cells on there and we're picking up its energy source. We need to re-clean it. It may be either food for bacteria to regrow, or it may be live bacteria that the disinfection process has missed completely. Visual, already mentioned that. Debs has mentioned it as well. The species, yeah, the 1% level, which spookily enough is about what these on-site ELISAs work to. I'm sure there was no connection between the level set by the FSA or recommended by the FSA and the fact that that's what was actually detectable. Although I do remember in Sudan 1 when it was going on, they were talking about picking up levels of undetectable quantities and thinking, levels of undetectable, you can't. It's by extrapolation. With allergens, again, you've got factory-based ELISAs that take about half an hour. You've got these lateral flows, which are, for those of you that have been fortunate enough to use them, a bit like home pregnancy test kits. But for allergens, and you don't need to wee on these ones, which is a benefit, quite useful. So you look for a variety of lines that tell you whether or not the allergen is present or absent. As blunt as that. But frankly, on a sandwich line, if you've just changed from a prawn sandwich to a chicken sandwich, you just need to know if you've got detectable levels of shellfish there, prawn there. If there's any there, you need to get rid of. So with verification, we're doing it after the cleaning process. No point looking before because we're not going to get the results we need. And again, you may use your ATP before or after disinfection, depending on the factory and how you feel when the disinfectant interacts with your ATP meter. The key is to be consistent, and that's true with cleaning and with validation and verification. You need to be consistent with it, not changing it around and one team does before disinfection, another team does afterwards, because then your results do this every other week. So it's about making sure you've got consistency and control and monitoring. So, very quickly, quick case study with species. We produced a product in our sausage factory that contained pork, carried out a validated clean down, mostly with the production manager gone, because we're doing that damn long cleaning. Which the technical manager's response was, well, you, bleep, 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 can phone Tesco's and tell them we can't clean the factory then because I'm not going to. They then produced the beef product through the line, took a first off the line sample and looked for the presence of pork. Okay, to see if there was any cross carryover. So that was a useful way of using the on-site test to determine whether or not the whole batch needs to be quarantined or just the first half an hour while they're doing this test. So we worked out that we can actually do a verification on site there and then. With a sandwich factory, company provides sandwiches, right, fine. The detergent and the blend we're using, so detergent, disinfectant, blend, commonly called a sanitizer, which is where the correct use of the term, because it's being done by generally production operatives, it's often being done against the clock. So, you know, we typically see changeovers in the sandwich industry of 5 or 6 minutes, and they may clean down 6 or 7 times an hour in a sandwich operation. And you multiply that across the shift, and that's a lot of cleaning time. We're using a neutral detergent, so we've got an emulsification of the fats and oils, so we're effectively using the fat and oil as a handle to lift the proteins away. And we can stick some biocide in it, so it kills the bugs at the same time. Double whammy. Again, we'll look at the efficacy of that based on visual, the ATP, and again a visual assessment and a rapid allergen test. We could spend a lot longer on validation and verifications, and we typically do. But that's a quick run through. Any questions? Questions at the end.